this is William Scott. Welcome back to the Folkways podcast. This is now the second of three parts of an interview I had with Tan Staffel on the Grimm's fairy tale, Snow White and Rose Red. So I hope you enjoy this next section. Thanks.
The group identity we have is to hate our own group, to despise our own group, to point at it and laugh and mock it and ridicule it and not feel sorry for it, to blame it for everything.
Yeah, and also since the 60s, it's been kind of this the transcendence of rebellion has kind of become the reality. I mean, we had punk rock when I was back in the early 80s, and that was our rebellion. It's this rejection of, and so what's it is this summary? Is it just a rejection of the past? I was just thinking the other day, my grandparents said to me, you should get, I mean, this is like 1978, maybe even earlier. You should get into computers because that's the future. I immediately said, eh, because they said it, I didn't do it. I had bought into this rather than, oh, these are my forebears. They bear wisdom because they've been alive and they've seen the world, and they're actually being quite progressive in their observation of the world. They didn't know nothing about computers. There weren't even personal computers in people's homes. And yet they knew that somehow. Maybe they heard it on somewhere, I don't know. But they gave me advice and I rejected it. And now today I'm suffering from my lack of HTML knowledge. Unable to get my WordPress.
I remember getting
signed up on Facebook because I'm ignorant.
You and I have a similar background. And I remember getting. We're very similar, I think, in our upbringing and age, and what we experienced back then. I got that kind of advice from a handful of people and ended up taking it. Not so much out of respect for my elders in the sense that you're talking about now, retrospectively, that's why I would do it. But back then it was just sort of a hunch that, yeah, okay, I'll look into it. And when I did, I was actually very interested in it and ended up making a career out of it. But, about your point about punk rock, there's a podcast that's been, bubbling in the back of my head to do for a long time about music and the culture, bit older than some of the young kids coming up now, that really grunge, I think, is their hippies or 60s to them. That's the old people that were around when they were little kids. For me, it was the hippies and the whole 60s freak out stuff was more like Hansel and Gretel or Snow White and Rose Red on acid. It was the first and even the beatniks before the that whole 60s freakout stuff was already a sign of really nasty stuff to come. And then it was a bad trip. It all crashed. And I think punk was actually a kind of Jew reaction then to that whole hippie thing. And it was very, very dark. And even grunge that came after punk was still very, very depressed. I mean, white kids and the white guys making that music, both punk and grunge, and not the Jews involved, but the white guys, sensed that there was something wrong, and they were making dark, angry music about it.
Yeah, and they were like the Canaries, right? They're sort of a document of the decay and of the decline. They're sort of unconsciously sort of vomiting up their. I mean, I really liked that music at the time. it spoke to me, but I lived in a disrupted world, in a disrupted family, all of those things, right? So that nihilism was, you attached yourself to this nihilism because everything else seemed to, you couldn't sort of believe or engage in something quite so innocent as, Snow White and Rose Red, this hopefulness. Hopefulness was gone. I mean, I had a kind of religious life after that, but at that time it was, there's something very, that whole just total disruption of a through line from past to present. I mean, the good news is it's a very short period of time really in human history. or in our people's history, I should say. I got to stop these generalized comments. It's really us that we care about, or that we're able to, even at some kind of respect, I don't want to colonize other people's reality, right? I want to just talk about my own reality and my own relationship with my own folk rather than trying to pretend that I... Because, I mean, as I said before, I mean, I think this is really what a lot of this multiculturalism and stuff is. I mean, when you want to go to war and you want to harass Uganda because they don't treat gays the way you want them to, I mean, this is an absurd world. I mean, this is a world gone mad.
I mean, it's just... Well, and I think it shows just how powerful ideas are and the morals. When I talk about morality, I'm talking about basically the definition of good and bad and how flexible it is that they can... At the same time, they're telling you, you got to open your borders up and you've got to be tolerant and whatever. They'll say, well, this country somewhere else is doing something reprehensible and we got to bomb them. And it's the opposite. You know, they're telling you basically to be peace loving and tolerant at home and open your borders. And at the same time to drop bombs, maybe even just via remote control from some shack in Miami on the other side of the world, just dropping bombs on people. But that is the power of the media. It's the power of repetition, and it's the power of that holding that megaphone, that big authoritative device, the TV that everybody has in their house. And when something comes out of the TV, I see it in friends that I talk to that suddenly they'll be babbling about ISIS and we got to do something about ISIS, or did you see what happened in Libya? And I think to myself, God, this is insidious. They're watching Fox News, and just that dripping in their ear is enough to convince them something about that problem. And that's the sign of optimism there is if those people get their heads screwed on right and listen to the right sources of information that are from a positive point of view about people like them, a pro-white, pro-European news source, then they would be able to come very quickly to conclusions about what really needs to be done and for their own interests, that they have interests. That's the first step.
We do change. I mean, that's the thing. We do change. And we also kind of have, I think, several scripts probably running at once. For me, I mean, I'm thinking about my own. Do you have time to keep carrying on here?
Oh, sure. Yeah. This particular word that you use, the script, reminds me of Lawrence Oster. Do you remember him?
No. I've heard you mention that, but I've never
looked at him. He had this thing. Well, it was something, it was very true. There's an element of truth to it. He used to call it the liberal script. And it was sort of another way of saying the same thing that he was always saying, which is that Oster's first law of majority-minority relations in a liberal society, which was basically this observation that the worse a minority group behaves, the better it needs to be treated. And it's like what we see with – he was thinking of the Muslims and how, you know, in spite of the fact that you've got these violent military age men flooding into Europe from Syria, the Middle East, North Africa, that the liberal system, which supposedly runs things, says that we must treat them. We must look the other way at this threat that they pose to us, and we must actually treat them really well. And he called it the liberal script in other contexts. My problem with that, I was already kind of wise to the Jews by this point when I heard him going on about this liberal script, is this script protects the Jews. That's where it comes from. That's when you hear even non-Jews like Angela Merkel or David Cameron in Europe or Obama talk about how things have to be done, they're talking about in terms of, well, we must serve the other. We must do this. Why? Because the Holocaust, because we don't want to be Nazis. And why is that? Well, it all boils down to because Jews. That's where these ideas come from. And I don't actually believe that people like Angela Merkel or David Cameron even think of themselves, really think piously about Jews. I think that they realize that that's just the sort of the cover story for how to do what they know they need to do, that what they know if they didn't do, they would be out of a job very quickly if they tried to defend their borders, if they tried to sink the boats instead of welcoming the people in, then they know that the real people who really control whether they have a job or not would put them out of that job very quickly. And it would be very unpleasant for them. And so they also realize that in order to keep their job and their nice position, their power, their money, their fame, they need to say this or that. And the this or that that they need to say is, well, you know, we have to open our hearts and Holocaust and gas chambers and all of that.
Yeah, let me finish my take on script.
Yeah, okay.
I just meaning that I'm just thinking of my own self. I mean, I kind of had parallel realities. You know, there was kind of several. I won't describe them all, but I did always have this racial awareness. Quite young, I realized, you know, that white people like certain kinds of music and black people like certain kinds of music. I mean, it's not. And, you know, and all this talk about how white people are uptight and that's the reason they don't. I mean, it's as if you can change, you know, as if it's a choice. You wake up every morning and you take your uptight medicine. So you make sure you stay uptight and not get groovy. Right. So there's something I always was just kind of aware of that disposition, that we had a certain kind of disposition. I don't always like it, but it's my disposition. You know, I mean, it's my rough tribal disposition. It's not all about, you know, being in love with ourselves all the time either. It's just acknowledging who we are for both those good things that we do, the good experiences we have, those things we share, but also our foibles, as we see in the story, right? We have a serious flaw about being able to be fooled or tricked or put under a spell. And the girls actually have a flaw too. They're kind of to a fault. You know, it takes somebody else to come in and correct that when they're actually going to be heard. This makes me think, though, that if I can be despairing for a moment, I mean, we actually are at that state where the other is harming our girls and we aren't responding. I mean, it's disgusting. This business about Rotherham and all over. And now this all over Germany. What was there, 5 cities where you had mobs of sex attackers? And everybody's very careful to say this wasn't organized. Wow, if it's not organized and that's just a spontaneous thing, that's even more scary. You know, I mean, if these populations merely like mushrooms, you know, like synergy, just rise up in inflamed passions, combination of alcohol, New Year's revel ring, and unwrapped women, that's even more scary. Then somebody was saying, okay, we're organizing this and we're going to do this on New Year's or something, right? But the New Year's thing in Muslims as a kind of attack on Europeans, I mean, they've been doing this in France for a long time. I didn't hear about because Germany seemed to overshadow it. But I mean, were there a bunch of car burnings again? Or it seems to be what happens every year in New Year's. They roll and burn cars.
That's 10 years going now. Yeah, the carbecues every New Year's.
Yeah. So it's there's this... That whole keep losing my thought.
Well, by script, you are alluding. By script, you're alluding to.
Waiting for your thumbs to twiddle. They're just paused. They're pausing.
What we referred to earlier, what I referred to as personality traits, is what you mean by script. It's an inborn behavior, and what McDonald calls implicit whiteness.
In a way, a little different. I actually kind of – I remember watching David Duke on Donahue. And this is – I mean, if you look – if you ever watch that video, if you've ever watched him on the Donahue show, it's worth watching.
Yeah, I didn't know he was on.
Oh, he was, yeah.
You mean David Duke or do you mean Jared Taylor?
No, David Duke. David Duke is a very young man, is on there.
I'll go look it up.
A very civil kind of conversation with Donahue. And what's interesting is this is early in the game, right?
Yeah.
And Donahue's quite civil with him. You know, Donahue now being who he was would have to be very aggressive with him, but he's not. He's quite, and he basically says you're a very well-mannered young man, but he just, you know, has to disagree with him or whatever, right? Or something like this. But I remember hearing him on there going, well, that makes sense. I was young, you know, I was 17 or 16 or whatever I was. And I thought, oh, sense will prevail. Because he wasn't saying anything mean. He wasn't, you know, I thought, I had kind of heard that these people are all mean, right? That they were, you know, calling for cross, you know, burning people and hanging people and stuff, right? So when I heard him, I thought, oh, well, that's reasonable. So I've always had that, I always had that script running through from my experiences in school and from that and from hearing people. And then the next thing was the Rushton, Suzuki. I won't call it.
I have seen that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's an, it's so funny to see leftists post this as the David Suzuki smacks down Philip Rushton. Really? I mean, even Suzuki knew he lost at the, on that debate. And then that, that beautiful Asian girl gets up at the end. And, I mean, beautiful in what she's saying. I came here for like information, and this is nothing. This is just emotional response, essentially what she says to Suzuki. And he's like, yeah, I know, but nobody else would do it. Like nobody who actually knew the material. So Suzuki quotes, says that this was sorted out 20 years ago. Like that's scientific. He quotes somebody from 20 years previous. Anyway, we'll get into that. But I kind of kept thinking reason would prevail and maybe prevail when the transition would be smooth. But reason is prevailing. I mean, the number of us is increased. The conversation is complex and nuanced. It's, you know, there's a lot of variety, a lot of very complex. And for me, I mean, I find it to be, just as a side note in general, this whole identitarian kind of identity and thought world is, I find it to be a very creative space for me. It gives me something to chew on. It allows me to actually think honestly in all directions. Whereas before there were all these walls up. I'd start thinking and I can't think down that road. That's an unacceptable path of thought.
Oh yeah.
So there was a lot of this kind of self-censorship, which kind of creates unhappiness in us, in our people at least, when we can't, and for those of us who are thinkers of our people, of which, you know, I'm not an accomplished thinker, I'm not a well-published thinker or anything, but thinking is what I do. It's all I've ever done.
Yeah, you mentioned that you...
I do it day in, day out.
You had actually worked for a while on a degree in philosophy, hadn't you?
Yeah. But it was in the 90s. It was very...
And you couldn't stand it. I remember you saying that.
Yeah, I couldn't stand the school. I was actually just depressed and kind of hating on myself. And also just feeling like, wow, I am so... Because I had come from this conservative religious tradition as well, that I had left and kind of was trying to be a secular atheist. And there were lots of reasons why I was very depressed. But the context, I mean, I remember the week that I heard they changed classical studies to Greek and Latin studies. I thought, oh my God, this is just never going to end, is it? This is just going to keep going. And you know, this was, but in some ways, these people, these nutters and of that time, it seemed like they were nutters, and we kind of humored them a little bit. We called them feminazis, and we thought that somehow that would come. I didn't honestly think they would end up being the rulers of the UN, which obviously is what they did. I was in history classes, decolonizing history classes. They're reading Said's. We're reading Orientalism. Mm-hmm. But we just seemed to be students. But then those students all got jobs in government, because what else do you do with a history degree?
That's
and
right.
We got jobs in all kinds of places. So these idealistic people working on this anti-Western script that they picked up at school are now ruling the world. Essentially,
yeah.
I mean, that from the 90s through there.
Well, it started even earlier than that. World War II, of course, is when the dramatic shift, when the battle was fought and lost. And in the decade after World War II, the UN was formed. And one among the first things that the UN did was pass all sorts of anti-racist world rulings that became basically the template for the agenda that was then rolled out across the West, at the very least, against discrimination by race, nationality, religion, whatever. And it's now, you know, XYZ, all sorts of different, in any way that they can divide us. And that's the irony, I guess, is that all the different ways that people would divide naturally, they have forbidden to be used as any sort of device to divide in a healthy way. It's in a self-interested way. Of course, they divide us along then unnatural lines, along left and right political ideologies, which make very little sense, are just labels we attach our loyalty to, and are serve as basically vessels for that our otherwise healthy instincts to be part of a group are redirected into, to rooting for a sports team, to, you know, all sorts of different things that stuff is shunted off into to be vented and wasted, misdirected.
Yeah. We're, I guess, yeah, maybe we got to kind of contain our conversation a little bit. I won't go there. We'll have another chat, I think. We just might have another conversation at some point down the road.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of dim on philosophy, but I sense that, you know, you would be a good person to hash out some of these things with. I did a long series on Francis Parker Yockey, and he was
a
meta-philosopher. And I'm not very impressed with the philosophy that I was exposed to in reading Yockey's accounting of it and his own take on it. The great philosophers of Europe have been examining their navels, as far as I can see, and have come to some really deep realizations, but they've all along missed this threat to our very existence within Europe. And I don't want to say, you know, broadly that they've all missed it entirely, because some of them, you know, Spengler is a good example, where it seems like he was mostly blind to what was going on. But he wrote, you know, about the decline of the West without actually putting his finger on the cause. You know, it's, from what I can tell, it just happens, you know, because that's nature. You know, societies or civilizations are like organisms, and they are born, they live, and they die. That was his explanation for it. But the reality is I think that, and the Jews demonstrate this, is if you're conscious of your organismhood, you can preserve it indefinitely, and you can out-survive other organisms, that there isn't just one organism that just is, back to this solipsistic idea, I think, that Spengler had in it, that in his thesis, that we are just, you know, floating on a ball circling around the sun, and shit just happens, and there's nothing we can do about it, when the reality is we have a competitor, and the competitor is inside our gates, telling us what to do, what's okay to do, what's not okay to do, and pretending to be us. And that's a big problem, because you can be killed by somebody who has that kind of access, who's literally in charge.
It's forever getting its yard-long beard stuck in a tree.
Yeah, in that sense.
And then asking for help.
In the Brothers Grimm days, it must have seemed, and it's partly in defense now of the great philosophers of Europe throughout history, is they didn't have the internet, they didn't have the depth of understanding at their fingertips to go look up. They could go to universities and study these things and learn from other men who knew, but what I'm trying to get at is that their knowledge, their access to knowledge, was much more constrained than what we have today. And they had justification to think of Europeans as superior, as in control, as all we need to do is decide we're going to do it, and we can do it, because there is no other power more powerful than us. But that kind of – today, that's ridiculous to think in those terms, to think that we can just do whatever we want, and it's just up to us to decide we want to do it. I mean, there's a part of me that wants to think that it is that simple. I think it is the simple step we need to take, of course, is to think of ourselves as us and as having an enemy, and then we can work from there. But to think it's just that it's over then, because now everything will just be straightened out, that's wrong. But in the past, I could forgive Europeans for thinking in those terms, because we're, for instance, 100 years ago, looking at 1920ths, in Yockey's terms, that 1920ths of the globe was was colonized and, or at least administered, ruled by the white man. The reality is that the British Empire was not really ruled by the white man for the benefit of the white man. It was ruled for the benefit of the Jews back in London who were pulling the strings on this thing, who said where to go next and who to rape next and who to, you know, what port to open up and where to, how to change the laws in those places. And yes, it was done, the soldiering, the brilliant soldiering and administration was done by real Englishmen and Brits. But my point is that it wasn't really British in the sense that it wasn't done for the benefit of the British people as a whole. And you made a comment earlier about colonization. It was a very quick reference, but what's happening today, I don't see as a flip. Many of these people like Yaki who mention the 1920s, how did we go from owning the whole planet, running the whole planet, to now being, you know, on the our backs and dying? It really wasn't this gigantic flip. You have to understand that the colonization that was going on then and the colonization that's going on today that seems to be the reverse of it is really just more of the same. It's the people pulling the strings and a good example is the Nazis, and World War II. In World War II, the British people were whipped up to go to war with this propaganda that we got to fight the Nazis because we absolutely cannot be ruled by Nazis. And yet here we are 70 years later and their country is being flooded with complete aliens. So obviously the message was not we can't be ruled by aliens. The message was we can't be ruled by Nazis. And today that's the same message. We can't be ruled by Nazis. They're more afraid of the native white Brits rising up, and Nazi is just code for racially aware, Jew aware white people. And that is still the enemy. And that is still who is not allowed to be themselves and to take control, because that would be bad for the Jews. And that's one of the things we can understand as white people. This is also something you referred to way back at the beginning of this conversation, how we imagine, if we just had a country for ourselves, we'd be happy, and where we could live and express ourselves, express our Europeanness. The Jews have that in Israel. They can go live there, or if they wanted to, they could carve out some place anywhere on the planet. They have that awareness and they have that power to do it. But that isn't, they're not satisfied with that. And that's part of what Zionism is this puppeteering, whether it's a inborn need or whatever. I think it's just an expression of who they are, that they are not happy to simply be masters of their own fate. That part of, to put it the best way that I can understand it, is part of being a master of your own fate is being the master of everyone else's fate as well, and puppeteering them and telling them what they need to do to best serve your interests.
Well, I mean, look at their mythology, right, to the back, or their legends. I mean, the story of Jacob is a story of, I'm sorry, Joseph is a story of an alien leader who rises to the top, but having impressed the Pharaoh with essentially magic, dream interpretation, who then manages to steal all of the, not manages to bank all of the food of the empire into its own coffers, mm-hmm. and control it. And I remember as a kid reading this, in Sunday school, and just never like thinking this didn't sound nice, We're supposed to see him as being wise, this wise person who was really maybe looking after the general interest or something. It was, I mean, there's your story. And then Daniel, too. Daniel rises to the top, engages in some dream interpretation. So always their myth is
interesting.
That they are participating in Esther, same thing, the story of Esther, even more so.
Yes, Purim.
Other than the Kings and Chronicles and the Judges and that period of time where they seem to have kind of a nativist or a nationalistic existence, they are existing as the uber class in other societies. And that's true right back from biblical times. I mean, those are the stories that they tell each other. That's how they understand themselves. I mean, yeah. This whole business is about dare to be a Daniel. It's about... I mean, facing the danger of the lion's den, I guess. It was kind of funny because that's kind of a metaphor for Aryan man, the lion, right?
I have a feeling that we have it within ourselves, too, meaning the Aryan white people. We certainly, that's how we do our farming. That's how we do our animal husbandry. I mean, we don't abuse our animals. We have a certain sympathy for, even a farmer doesn't make his animals suffer unnecessarily, even if he's raising them for meat and ultimately mm-hmm. does butcher them. But we are able to do that with animals. And our problem seems to be that with human beings, we think differently. And this back to this question of how much of that is inborn in us and that we do it naturally, and how much of it is actually manipulated and impressed and indoctrinated into us by the media that we're given by the Jews that serves their interests, that we should not think of anyone as being other from us. We should think of everybody as being us. All the whole human race is us. And I've said that before, how we're not, it's part of our problem is that we retreat into individualism. McDonald, I heard recently talking about it. He thinks that's what's inborn into us is this tendency toward individualism. But I see actually there's a completely in the opposite direction tendency to think in terms of the whole human race. And I think that's a perversion of our own tendency to think in terms of groups beyond the individual. Feelings that would of loyalty or affinity for our race at a racial level are being shunted one way or the other, either shoved down toward individualism and greed to just worry about our own interests, or being shunted in the opposite direction to worry about, you know, people who are completely alien from us and think of them as us. It's okay to think of what's good for the human race. That's another politically acceptable way to deal with the current zeitgeist. You can't worry about just the white race. That's absolutely forbidden. But if you want to worry about the whole human race, especially as it gets ever broader with these anthropological discoveries of new species of man-ape that they keep finding, that's all just, you know, the narrative there is that we're just discovering our long-lost cousins. You know, they're all part of us.
I think though, that we... I mean, the only reason we're able to do that, this isn't such a part of our disposition that it's, again, the driver. It's because we have a surplus. We've created economic surplus. We generally can't imagine that we are actually in decline, even though many of us are, that our poorer people suffer the most in terms of having to live adjacent to hostile competing races in the United, well, now everywhere. So this idea that we don't have, it's the surplus that's creating this sense of we have enough, we have to share.
Yeah.
But we're not awake to the, enough of us aren't awake to the fact yet that we're giving away the core. You know, we aren't just inviting somebody to dinner, we're giving away our house. You know, it's, and yet we can't, you know, Markle can't stop inviting people to dinner, you know, no matter even if they,
yes.
you know, even if they burp at the table, even if they rape your daughter at the table.
Right.
Even if whatever they do, it's not, it's just not.
What she's giving away isn't really hers to give away.
And it isn't hers to give away.
Really?
Exactly. Have you ever seen that little clip where somebody hands her a German flag and she treats it like it's the Nazi flag? You saw that?
She actually sees it. She's on stage and sees some other politician sort of waving it kind of lamely. And she grabs it out of his hand and like tosses it off to the side. They're not allowed to be proud of being a German or to wave the German national flag. That's true in Britain, too. They're, you know, taking down the Union Jack because that's racist. And you can't wear the American flag on Cinco de Mayo Day in American schools because that's racist. It's provocative to the mestizos who might riot and cause a problem if they see it.
I mean, it comes back to this. Yeah.
Look, back to Merkel. There was a point I wanted to make about Merkel and pathological altruism. So first of all, Merkel is not being altruistic with her own personal resources. What she's doing is giving away other people's resources. And, you know, that's not really altruism. There's got to be another name for it, because it's a different psychological mechanism, there's a different payoff there, and a different.
It's not exactly theft. It's a weird kind of theft.
Yeah,
I mean, in terms of the positioning of the
theft. Other people's money is the common expression for it. You know, when you're spending other people's money, you're not behaving in the same way you would if you were spending your own money. And that was there was a reward and punishment connected to what you're doing. And that goes to the point I want to make, which is with Angela Merkel, what they are doing is objectively destroying – what Merkel is doing is objectively destroying Germany as it is. She's done it in such a quick period of time, and with a stroke of a pen, or I don't even know she had to sign anything into law if it was just a wave of a hand. But basically what needs to happen is that somebody needs to do the math in their head or feel the emotions in their head that says, I cannot take this anymore, and I am going to do something about it for my people because I am outraged. And why doesn't somebody do that? And I can think of a million reasons why, excuses why I can't do it. You know, I'm not a German. I don't have the money to fly over there. Or if I was a German, I might get caught. I don't want to spend my life in jail. It's about pain. It's about punishment. It's about not wanting, and that we're not suicidal, basically, is the point I can make.
I think there are other ways. I mean, I mean to say that we don't have these dark moods would be to be dishonest with ourselves. But I think that there are other ways to express will. This maybe takes us out of this conversation of the other and brings us back to the conversation of ourselves. That we need, I mean, a couple of things. First of all, in this movement, somehow we need to have each other's back. Like, I'm thinking of Ursula
Haverbach.
I mean, what is happening to support her? I mean, what a heroic woman, right?
No.
An aged woman. And she, you know, I'm not sure what's happening, but I mean, or even flowers being laid at the jail. Maybe she's not in still. It wasn't a super long sentence, but I mean, give me a break. An 87-year-old woman. This is a disgusting, disgusting thing. But what's more, what's so shameful about where I feel the shame and the responsibility is, you know, will I stand up? I mean, in a way, now that I'm not favoriting my podcast on my Facebook page where all my university friends and everybody in this town knows me, right? But it's still my stupid mug that I've got out there, and it's too late now. It's gone, right? But I mean, it's in a sense I'm thinking courage is required. I'm not saying you're not being courageous. I think your work is phenomenal, and I'm not sure even what I'm doing. Who am I? Nobody knows who I am. I'm just some newbie. But I think somehow we have to have each other's back. I mean, we have to know that we're safe. And there's still this. You talked about trust. I'm in even just reaching out to you. I just knew from listening to you that I could trust you. I knew you weren't a plant or you weren't an agent or some ridiculous thing like this, right?
Right. Well, I appreciate that. That's what I was getting at earlier, that we have these instincts, especially if we listen closely to what people are saying, that we can sort of we can understand whether they're telling the truth or whether they're trying to bullshit us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so it, in a sense, it's the Jedi trick. I mean, in some ways, I think we have to just start. And I'd say you've already done that in the body of work you've created. We just simply need to just posit the stuff into space and, in a sense, stop worrying about the fallout. Oh, yeah, I mean, I was here in Canada when this whole thing about Ernst Zundel was going down, too. And I thought, oh, again, it was like, oh, that sounds reasonable. And then no, reason didn't win, right? This is, I kept thinking reason would win. That's just backing up on that point. But I mean, at some point, maybe it's critical mass. Maybe that's what it is. Like, we need a critical mass. There seems, I mean, the number of people and interesting people too, and smart people, and and very virtuous people like Ayla that are coming on side in their own way. I mean, she has her own focuses and stuff, but I mean,
it speaks to us. It's being rational and facts and statistics, that kind of thing appeals to white people because of our objective, rational tendencies. My point about that is that it will not win the day against the dwarves, against the Jews, against the other non-whites. We're our failing is in thinking that's part of, you know, the problem with projecting ourselves and our own what we value or think is important, and thinking that everybody else is just a white person who might not just, you know, be in a white package, but their brain is like a white person. Or that they could become like one, that we make arguments to them, that we might have a black friend and we say, well, look, but, you know, the black crime is out of hand and it's not a gun problem, it's a black problem. That's not going to work on your black friend. Your black friend is going to not be your friend anymore if you talk to them like that. And that's just the reality. Get used to it.
Unless he's Tony Sotomayor. You might listen to. Yeah, so back up here. I'm gonna have to go out. The kids and I are going out for dinner tonight at 9. Very European.
Good for you. Thanks for spending so much time talking. I think it was a fantastic
No, I want to carry on. I've still got another whatever. But you probably got your family to get back to, but you just sparked my memory about what I was gonna say before about philosophy.
Go ahead.
And yeah, a lot of philosophy is worthless in terms of the writing of words about speculative discussions of the world, right? Or at least they have a limited value for, you know, a certain period of time or something or other, right? But it's the skills. I mean, I think there's two things. One, it's only a tool. It's very good at doing certain kinds of things. It's good at like epistemology. This is the study of the nature of knowledge. How do we know a thing's true? What is criteria? How do we, these, to me, the two important things in terms of our, you know, in the broader truth movement, which is kind of what a lot of us have come through, right? This kind of veracity became enlivened in us and also craved, right? We craved truth because we had been given so much hokum, right? And so this need to, this craving for veracity, well, that's this epistemological drive. I mean, look at Aristotle. He's your probably your best starting point. And then there's also ontological. How do things come to be? What is it that things are? And this is our racial reality, right? It's our ontological reality. What is it that we become? And that's what I see these fairy tales as, a document of our becoming. Because they're as I said, in my other interview, they're too smart to, they know too much about us, too far back to be just sort of, you know, quaint stories or some propaganda or something like this, right? They are a deep record of, and they resonate with us in this deep, deep way. So this, but ultimately, action is what wins the day. It's not veracity. I mean, Muslims are going to win not because Islam is correct, but because they have a will to power. So this brings us to Nietzsche. But the will to truth, the will to power. The will to power wins over the will to truth. The will to truth is, in a sense, sometimes a luxury that we have for doing certain kinds of things, for inventing things. You know, you can't not have a high value of truth and engage in science or technology in your own work. I mean, I think that's the reason a lot of people on this side are coming from programming, because, you know, words actually have power. They have meaning. You're typing them in and they control electrons and make things happen because they're strung up in the right way. And if they're not strung up in the right way, then things don't work the way they should.
Yeah. I'd never thought about it that way, but that is a good point.
And so logic and syntax in computer programming, similar to logic and language, ideas flow through, but that's a concrete way. But in terms of our own selves, it's really whether or not you choose to act. You know, it's actions in the world that create reality. And then that reality can be discussed by somebody, sociologist, anthropologist, philosopher.
Yeah, you know,
it's a discussion after the fact. It's the person who acts that gets things done.
Yeah.
You know, you want to act smartly. I mean, a lot of stupid actions, for sure. But it's sort of both. There isn't one without the other, in a way. There's no reason to act well if you don't have a good, sound understanding of yourself. But just having an understanding of yourself without acting is meaningless, too.
If our strength is will to truth, then we ought to be able to see the truth that we need a will to power, that we need a we need a will to be, and that whatever it takes, we will be. And it's really that simple, I think. And when I think of Islam, I think the advantage that they have is an organizing principle. They have a religion that is adaptive. It does not encourage them to degeneracy and biological degeneracy. Now I'm thinking of homosexuality or childlessness, and the very basic biological equation there that Western belief systems have become so perverted now that even the Christian faith that was sort of a framework for Europeans for so long and was kind of okay, didn't screw with the family too much, has now been perverted to the point where even the churches are promoting this homosexuality and trans insanity that it's just now shown its weakness. But it's, you know, Islam is not it's not perfect, and it's not invulnerable. It can also be perverted and twisted. And one example I can think of is how they fight amongst themselves over little ideological differences, very much like how Christianity shattered into a million different sects or a thousand different sects in Europe and was the source of millions of death and all untold suffering amongst Europeans. Islam has had similar breakdowns. You know, in the end, the Western technology, when 10,000 U.S. military guys get on an aircraft carrier or you know, C-130s and fly halfway around the world, they are able to just flatten whatever Muslims can put up against them. It's not even a fight. It's the what where the Muslims win is in they have a spiritual understanding of themselves as an ummah, as a people, and a willingness to do whatever it takes to blow themselves up in fighting the infidel. And in that respect, they are superior and will ultimately win in the long term, in the same way that the Vietnamese beat the Americans, because the Americans are there fighting with these wishy-washy ideas about freedoms and liberty and women's rights to wear bikinis in public and, you know, other bizarre things that they the point I'm trying to make is a point I've made before, which is we are technically the best at war and technology in general, but war specifically. Our problem is that our targeting system is not being controlled by us. It is Jews who have, to put it bluntly and briefly, hijacked and control that targeting system now. And so our enemies are not our real enemies. The enemies that we are targeting are the enemies that they decide are their enemies and need to be destroyed. And back to the Esther story in Purim, you know, this is a theme throughout Jewish history where they actually glorify this idea of playing one group of goyim against another, and the goyim destroy each other, and the Jews celebrate in the end their great victory. And that's what's being done in Europe right now, with them directing all these Muslim refugees, these invaders, into Europe, literally helping them ashore and giving them maps and supplies and saying, there's Berlin, go to Berlin.
Directions to the benefits office.
Right? Yeah, and they are creating what a tinderbox here, a powder keg that is inevitably going to lead to a bloody mess. It's there's war. A tremendous war is going to happen in Europe, and that's what's being set up right now. That's the gunpowder is being packed in Europe right now.
Well, that is the second part of three from Tan Stoffel and my conversation about Snow White and Rose Red. As you can see, we get into some pretty challenging material, especially at the end. But this is, to me, one of the big issues that face us at this point, is that those of us who can see this and have some basic sense of history and social development can see quite clearly that by placing people side by side in this way, and people who are already fighting, and or at least being one group is being attacked by another group, no matter how much the establishment media and the powers that be, both municipal and federal and state, whatever that is in Germany, regional, no matter how much they try to tell us that we just have to be nice and figure out how to get along with these people, this is not what's happening. And there is no place in Europe where there is large-scale success in integrating Islamic communities with white, traditional white, post-Christian and still remaining and remnant Christian communities. This idea that somehow we can, just morally bully an entire continent into accepting its dilution and ultimately its demise is quite bizarre to behold when you are awake to the fact that this is what's happening. So there's no way to avoid this reality. If things continue the way they are, we will be looking at more and more an increase in violent conflict. If the solution is supposed to be that the states of these countries are actually going to turn on their native population to oppress them and to use state violence against them in order that the new populations can be welcomed without resistance, that is the strangest development in the history of the world. I would love to see examples of that from somewhere else, and I can't imagine that they would prove to be healthy in any way. I mean, in what way does it make sense for a people to elect a government that then acts against those people and then treats those people as pathological and criminal for complaining against their own demise?